A horizontal bar of static expands to fill the view, then resolves into letters, HBO. White dots coalesce on a black background to form the text, HBO Documentary Films. The shadows behind letters shift as the light changes to shine behind them. Vulcan Productions. Creative differences. Text, produced by Vulcan Productions Incorporated and Creative Differences.
Okay, we're here with Bud Hedeke, and we're rolling.
This is the song that I wrote for my bomb group and all the guys that made it or didn't make it. It's to the melody of I'll Be Seeing You. I'll be seeing you on all the missions that we flew, and also with your good old crew the whole day through. Enemy fighters and flak, the sound of loud ack-ack, and lucky we got back to our ground crew on that day we flew. I'll be seeing you at good old Diefengreen in your sleek flying machine. Oh, the one called Mighty Queen. I'm gonna look for you in skies of blue. And when your flights are through, I'll be seeing you in my dreams, and I'll be missing you. Thank you.
Paul Bud Hedeke, Bombardier, 8th Air Force, age 92. A title appears, The Cold Blue. In vintage footage, a blonde white woman in a crowd smokes. A red-haired white woman shades her eyes briefly as she looks at something with a grin. A round-faced white woman does the same. Text, in the summer of 1943, the crew of an 8th Air Force B-17 returned from Europe to tour the United States. The crowd watches as a B-17 plane flies toward a runway. They were brought back to boost morale on the home front. In footage from inside the B-17, the plane rolls quickly up a runway. More planes sit parked in a row nearby. The plane approaches the crowd slowly. A uniformed airman holds up his arms to signal the plane to continue forward. A white man in a gray suit stands at a microphone on a platform decorated with red, white, and blue bunting. A man in the crowd claps. At the time, the men in their airplane, the Memphis Belle, were the focus of a documentary directed by William Wyler. The crowd walks over to the parked plane. They stand in a huge, dense group. Some people touch the bottom of the plane. Yellow lettering on the side of it reads, Memphis Belle. A brunette white woman stands over a white woman with glasses and presses her hands against the plane. White writing sits around a group of painted names on the siding. A white boy with glasses writes on the plane. An airman holds a small black dog in his arms. In the nose of the plane, another airman holds the dog. The dog looks out the clear window. A group of men in the crowd listens as one of the uniformed airmen talks into the microphone on the platform. A pale man in a brown hat points a camera at the platform. The speaker stands on one foot briefly as he adjusts his pant leg. The crew was one of the first to survive flying 25 missions over Europe. More airmen lean against a railing behind the speaker. Sunlight shines on the plane behind them. In 1943, the odds of surviving 25 missions were less than 25%. The airmen walk in a row down a path through the crowd. The people in the crowd applaud. The footage slows as the men step forward. The Memphis Belle's crew have since passed away, but Wyler's footage and the few remaining 8th Air Force veterans bear witness to that war in the cold blue. The crowd watches as a plane flies overhead. two planes fly over the vast blue ocean. In footage from inside one of the planes, someone moves inside a shadowed area semi-open to the water below.
Well, I don't know what the odds were all against you. It was more or less like being in death row in a penitentiary, waiting on your turn, and you knew it was coming.
One of the men eats.
You fly a real tough mission, and you're so glad to get back, and everybody says, boy, we made it through that one, didn't we? And then next morning they come in, put the flashlight in your face. All right, boys, get up. You're going to be leaving. We're going to be flying in 2 hours. Now that's tough.
A gunner holds the end of a machine gun out of the open side of the plane.
I was 21 years old, yeah. And we felt like we could live forever.
A dark-haired airman smokes.
Don't get me wrong. We still get that tight feeling when we would see bursting flak nearby, when we see fighters. We still get that feeling, but you can't make a living that way. All you could do is make a dying.
Dozens of planes fly in formation through the air. Small puffs of smoke hover in the distance.
Anybody said they weren't afraid, they were full of crap. Because you were always afraid what was going to happen next. Particularly in flak, you just waited for something to go off around you.
Sunlight shines on a young airman's stern face.
And that's when the fighters would come up.
One of the gunners puts his hand on a belt of ammunition as he peers outside through a panel. Two planes fly in the distance. He puts his gloved hand up and blocks the sun. One of the planes turns. Shells fall to the side as he shoots at the enemy plane. Another gunner shoots beside him out of the opposite side of the plane. Smoke streams from the bottom of a plane. Its propellers continue to turn. A black and white photo of a young white woman with dark coiffed hair sits taped inside the plane. A light pulses nearby. Planes dot the air above the water.
One of the men in our crew kept saying, I know I'm not going to make it, et cetera, et cetera. And you don't like to hear that. And he was very concerned because his wife was expecting within a day or two. And the next day they had him flying, which they shouldn't have had. And they took so many men from our crew to fly with him, and they never made it back. They crashed into the channel. And incidentally, and this isn't storytelling, but he was killed the day his son was born.
White dots move over a beige background as a film reel runs out. A plane appears to fall as it flies through the clear blue sky. A camera sits on a stand as planes fly overhead. To film his documentary, William Wyler and three cinematographers flew on bombing missions with the 8th Air Force. One of the cinematographers, a brown-haired white man, holds a camera to his eye as he films from a plane. One of these cinematographers was killed after his plane went down over France. Another cinematographer wears a helmet, goggles, and an oxygen mask as he films outside a plane. The wind blows the collar of his jacket up. During World War II, more men died flying in the 8th Air Force than would die serving in the U.S. Marines. Text, No Tomorrow. Footage of airmen walking in a group past various military buildings. Voice of John Ketzner, Navigator, born May 11th, 1921.
The war came and we went and did what they told us to do. That's the only thing I know. The Japanese ruined my youth because I was 20 years old or 19 years old. Everything was wonderful, and the Japanese and wealth, one fell swoop, ended all of that. And it lasted 4 years.
Al Villagran, radio operator / tail gunner.
Well, I can see why they get young fellows to fly to war, or ground, or submarines, and so forth. When you're younger, you feel you can do anything. I think when you get older, you get smarter.
V.G. Alexander, lead pilot, born October 6th, 1921.
That was a 19-year-old navigator, a Jewish kid, sharp as a tack. And I had some older boys. My bombardier was 26 years old. I was 22, 23.
William Toombs, flight engineer, born May 8th, 1924.
The oldest man we had in the crew was a Pennsylvania Dutchman, 32 years old. We called him Pappy. 32 years old. Our navigator was 26, and everybody else was anywhere from 22, 23. I can look back now and see why young people are in the war, not older people. Older people got better sense.
A group of airmen stands in a circle around another man as he shakes their hands. Paul Bud Hedicke, bombardier, born May 30th, 1925.
Sometimes they say the older you get, the more wiser you get. There weren't too many, I don't think, younger, too much younger than me. I flew every one of my missions at 19. The old man on our crew was our waist gunner. He was 25.
Airmen shake hands and pat each other. John Doyle, waist gunner, born February 11th, 1925.
I'll tell you, when we got into this thing, you wanted to fly, and you had a great time training and all that. But when you got over there and had got shot at it the first time, you knew you were in deep doo-doo. And that you really took life seriously after that.
One airman grabs a shorter airman. Robert Rowland, ball turret gunner, born January 9th, 1925.
They said we was going to fly 30 missions. You know, they started out at 25. Now they changed it to 30 when we got there. Then we got 26 missions in, and they give us a week off. And we come back, and they says you're going to fly 35. And that was kind of a shock.
Glenn Harrison, co-pilot, born March 11th, 1920.
Well, I seemed like I was flying all the time. There were 40 bomb groups. Our bomb group had a lot of people. I don't know the logistics of keeping the fuel and the ammunition, loading the bombs at night, getting them ready for the next day. I don't know how they did it.
Footage from an airfield. Morton Kimmel, bombardier, born May 11th, 1923.
When you're in a position like that, there's no tomorrow. You do everything that you want to do, that you can do, when you feel like doing it. And do it then, because you may not get the chance to do it again.
Footage from inside the cockpit of a plane as it flies over land. The blur of propeller blades spin just outside the window. Roads and strips of water appear to cut the land into sections from above. The pilot glances out the window as he flies. The reel runs out. The screen cuts to black. Text: fresh eggs. During the Second World War, 135,000 men flew with the 8th Air Force, flying nearly 3 million combat missions over Europe. Missions over Germany were considered the most dangerous. Unlike the British, who flew mainly at night, Americans were ordered to fly in broad daylight over heavily defended targets. A plane sits silhouetted before a vivid purple and orange sunrise.
Wouldn't be unusual, they'd wake you up The first thing you'd do would be go to the mess hall to eat. The mess hall was all lit up and everybody was laughing and talking, and usually they had Berlin Lynn or whatever her name was on the radio broadcasting. We hadn't been briefed yet. We didn't know where we was going to go, but this lady in Berlin knew where we were going to go, and she says, "Boys, you've got a tough one today. You're going to so-and-so, and we'll be waiting on you." And so that they knew more than we did.
Clouds stretch across the sky. Inside a military building, uniformed airmen walk in carrying mugs.
Now, in the Air Force, when we went to the kitchen for breakfast and we were getting, say, eggs, we get powdered eggs. That's what they had. Once in a while, we would get fresh eggs. You could get two over easy, and this was a treat. But we knew after a while that when you got fresh eggs, it meant you were going to have a real tough mission. So they gave you fresh eggs. That's the story. We don't want fresh eggs, but we want fresh eggs.
Outside, three airmen crouch together. One unfolds a large paper and lowers it down between them. Another points at something on the paper.
When you go into get ready for a flight, you go into the locker room, and you wore long johns. And then you'd wear the heated suit, put that on. And we had gloves that were attached to those. You had to get your gloves into those. They came clear around your ankles, too. And then you had your flight suits. Those are the things that you just wore.
Airmen enter a debriefing room full of huge maps and take a seat.
Then you'd load back on a truck and they'd take you to the area where the debriefing rooms were. So all the crews and everything would be sitting there waiting, and they had a sheet over the wall. They'd pull a sheet back and say, "Our target today is Germany. The weather looks pretty good as near as we can tell."
At the front of the room, a man uses a pointer to gesture to certain spots on a hand-drawn map.
One thing always got me about these briefings, the Catholic chaplain, he was back in the corner hearing confessions and giving out communion. So he knew that he was going someplace he might not come back from.
A cross sits between two lit candles on a table. Airmen gather before a Catholic chaplain who blesses them. The scene fades to black. Text, a sudden boom. Toward the end of the war, it was not uncommon for missions to include over 1,000 airplanes. These planes would take off from many different English air bases and merge into one mass formation. This time-consuming process was one of the most dangerous parts of any mission. A pilot sits inside a plane. Blue writing on the siding next to a graphic of a red bird reads, "Thunderbird." The propellers start turning. Wind blows against the surrounding greenery and pushes against the short grass. The plane rolls forward. A white man with glasses watches from inside a building.
That was one of the most amazing things of the war, the choreographing of putting 1,100 airplanes together in formation to go over.
One airman says something as he watches out a window.
We'd all line up on the perimeter strip that come around to the end of the runway. And the lead ship would attach you around and line up. And when they fired the flare to take off, that lead ship went down a runway.
One of the planes moves forward on a runway.
Next man pulled right up behind him. 30 seconds, he moved.
Another plane turns onto the runway.
30 seconds, the third man moved. Every 30 seconds, the plane was going down that runway. That lead plane never got off the ground before that second plane was already running.
The Catholic chaplain stands on the ground and waves as a plane picks up speed and lifts off the runway. The chaplain mouths something as he watches the plane leave. Another plane moves forward.
Well, we just spin out there on the end of the runway and give it full throttle, and you had to have enough speed for it to lift all that load up. You had a full gas load, you had all your ammunition for the guns, you had the bomb load.
Footage of a plane's tail as it rolls on the runway. From the front window, black skid marks stretch across the runway. Yellow letters on the side of the plane read DF next to a star. The DF plane gains speed as it moves down the runway. It lifts into the air. Another plane takes off. Below, a uniformed man stands on top of a car with a camera. A plane flies overhead, silhouetted against the sky. More planes take off from the runway. Letters on the side of one read JJ. A plane's wheels lift off the runway. They slowly retract up into the plane. Inside one of the planes, the bombardier wears headphones as he sits in the front. He looks outside as they move down the runway. In the sky, the sun glows orange.
Of course, while you're up there, I could see the sun coming up around Earth. And I thought that was the most weird thing, to see the sun coming up and it's dark on Earth, you know? But you realize what was happening to you. And then next thing you know, well, the sun come up and you see all these airplanes circling, straining, so to speak, to get up to the altitude with a heavy load of bombs.
A group of planes flies in the distance. Sunlight glows behind a covering of clouds. More groups of planes fly throughout the bright blue sky.
You had to form up, and you had a circle you were supposed to fly till you got formed up with your group. And then there'd be another bomb group over here. And one day we come within 3 or 4 inches of whacking up with another bomb group.
A shadow passes over a plane in flight. Letters on the side next to a star read LL. An open panel sits near a painted letter H.
Well, on some of them, when the young pilots had come in as replacements, if I was first man to take off, we'd be up in the air and say 200 to 300 feet climbing. All of a sudden,
a crashed plane smokes.
See a bright flash, red flash, and stuff coming down. You knew darn well it was in mid-air collision. And those were scary times as far as getting up.
Fires burn on the debris.
Two B-17s. One came down right on top of the other. They all went to their death. That's when I start smoking, by the way.
In blurred footage, a plane's propellers turn. The scene cuts to black. Text, you're a family. The average B-17 crew consisted of 10 men. Shadows obscure two airmen as they move inside a plane. These men would train together, fly together, and live together as they accumulated the ever-increasing number of missions they needed to return home. Two airmen talk and smile as they sit next to one another.
Well, actually, I believe that our officers were closer to their crew than they were with other officers.
A young white airman smiles and looks down.
As a crew, most crews stuck pretty well together. We did a lot together.
The young airman says something, then grins and peers upwards.
I don't think we would have appreciated one new man join us. We knew what each man was capable of doing. Each man did his job good, and no one complained.
Inside a plane, an airman writes something down.
We were family in the air. You absolutely had to be. We all had our duties.
We just wanted to stay together. And we flew 25 missions as a crew, all of us together.
The tube attached to an airman's oxygen mask shifts as wind blows into the plane.
Your family. Exactly. You have to be. However, I can remember one mission when our flight engineer came out smashed, and I climbed all over him. I said, "What is wrong with you? We depend on one another."
Three airmen pose together in front of the Memphis Belle.
There's a lot of spit and polish by the officers, and that didn't happen. Like you say, we're a family of brothers, and we didn't have time for all that stuff. But there was no saluting and yes sir, no sir, and all that. Each guy was his own guy.
Well, of course, each man would do his job, and we all knew exactly who was going to do what, so to speak.
The men lounge on grass.
So I knew I had a good crew. And we just got along beautifully.
One man lies with his head propped against the side of another man sleeping on the grass behind him. The scene cuts to black. Text, tremendous workers. Each B-17 was tended to by four mechanics and a crew chief, with bombs loaded and armed by a separate team. That crew chief was the only man on base who could authorize an airplane to fly. Two mechanics work on a plane.
We had a crew chief that took care of that plane after we got it back off a mission. So the three of us walked that plane, looked at everything on the ground, asked him all the questions we could think of. If there was any little thing that we thought we should pay particular attention to, for him to tell us.
A mechanic places a canister on the ground near a plane. A ladder sits next to one of the propellers. More men work on the plane together. An airman drives a small vehicle away.
You never flew the same plane all the time. It's just like your car having an ouchie and you take it into Firestone or somewhere to get fixed. They'd work overnight, all night long, trying to patch planes.
One of the mechanics replaces a small side panel on one of the planes. He pushes it into place.
As soon as you got in, they would take care of any damage. They would get in the plane and check the engines out, start them up and check them out. They would clean up everything.
Mangled metal hangs off of a plane. Shattered glass mars a window.
Tremendous workers. They were so good. We came back in B-17s with two engines, with the tail fin shot up and busted away, with all kinds of holes in the plane. And in 2 days, that plane was flying missions again.
Large bombs sit stacked into a neat row. Graffitied letters mark the side of one. Smaller yellow bombs sit inside containers next to them. Airmen push one of the large bombs forward as chains hold it in the air.
Well, we had armor on our crew, and he'd be there when there was most cases, not all cases. Sometimes the plane would be loaded before we ever got there.
Various airmen sit on the large bombs as vehicles transport them.
The armor gunners took care of all of that. They bring them out on big carriers, and it was a dangerous job.
More bomb-carrying vehicles drive down a dirt road. One vehicle turns as the one behind it continues in a straight line.
We did not load the bombs, no, but we did come out and check.
Two airmen each straddle yellow bombs with black stripes. One of them plays a harmonica as the bomb-carrying vehicle drives them forward. They approach a plane, then turn. Someone spins an object at the back of one of the bombs. A tag attached to it moves as they tighten it.
They were all fused, and they had fusing wires stuck through the propeller.
An airman pulls a fusing wire across the top of a bomb and then secures it.
These fusing wires were hooked on the shackles that the bombs were hung on. And when they left the plane, it would pull the wire out.
A group of airmen pushes a cart of bombs to a plane.
Now the bomb is alive. If you've seen movies and you hear bombs going down, that's this fuse spinning out.
Someone screws a small propeller-like object onto the end of a bomb.
Now the bomb is live, and once it hit, of course, it detonates. We had two missions where I had to go back in the bomb bay and put the cotter pins back in, and that is a little hairy. Why? Because when you landed, if you didn't, the bombs were armed, and if you had trouble, of course, you'd detonate.
A device lifts one of the yellow and black bombs. Airmen ride on a small vehicle. It comes to a stop. Some climb off the front and back, while others get out from inside. A few of the airmen carry luggage over to a plane. Later, mechanics watch as the plane begins its takeoff. From underneath the plane, one of the shadowed wheels lifts off the runway. The runway stretches behind the plane as it rises higher and higher off the ground. The scene cuts to black. Text: beautiful sight. The flight from England to the intended target could take 5 hours. In order to form up and make this round trip, B-17s could be airborne 14 hours. Idle intercom chatter among the crew was officially discouraged. But those orders were often ignored. Planes fly in formation together.
Well, we talked about just about everything. Our families, etc. It didn't matter what it was. We kept pretty much of a running conversation between everybody. It made the mission go a little easier.
Inside a plane, one of the airmen picks up a paper and a utensil. Lights shine on a landmass below.
First thing it did, as soon as we cleared the coast of England, everybody would test their gun.
A machine gun goes off. Bursts of smoke emerge from the muzzle with every shot. Sunlight shines off the deep blue rippled ocean beneath a plane.
Well, of course I can only speak for myself, but when you're in hostile territory, and I was in a top turret, so all of my vision was 360, 90 degrees this way, you know.
Contrails stream behind the B-17s as they fly through a bright blue sky. The vapor spreads as it disperses into the air.
Contrails form at the tail of the ship. The moisture in the air and the ship flying through it made the contrails. And a lot of times you wouldn't have them. It depends on the amount of moisture in the air.
Contrails form off of various planes as they fly. The streaks of white vapor hang in the blue sky like wispy clouds as the planes continue onwards. In footage from the back of a plane, contrails appear to flow towards one another. The contrails linger behind multiple planes as they fly. In blurred footage, contrails appear to glow.
Couldn't see a prettier sight than that. Kind of spellbound, you know, spellbound. A beautiful sight.
Contrails flow steadily from the backs of planes as they fly.
If you're watching it on the ground over in Germany, they tell me it took about 30 minutes for them all to come over. They said on a clear day that the Germans could see us coming 50 miles out from the contrails. And unfortunately, when that happened, that wasn't too good because they were ready for us.
Thin contrails stream behind two groups of planes as they fly over a clouded area. The scene cuts to black. Text, beautiful ship. At the beginning of World War II, only a few hundred B-17s were in service. By 1945, 12,731 had been built. Close to 5,000 were lost in combat over Europe. A B-17 sits parked near a patch of red flowers. A breeze ruffles the bright blooms. Yellow flowers grow behind the plane.
In 1938, I was down in Chile, and they flew a goodwill tour down there. I remember going out with my father and seeing these big planes.
Shadowed figures move near the back of a plane.
And I said to my father, someday I'm going to fly in one of those. Little did I know.
A B-17 flies smoothly through the air.
The B-17 was not only a beautiful ship, but it flew like a dream. It flew like a overgrown Piper Cub.
A B-17 flies above the clouds.
It flew nice and smooth, beautiful. Took a lot of punishment.
A B-17 lands on a runway.
The greatest airplane ever built, as far as I'm concerned. They brought us back 35 times, sometimes in condition that you would never even think of trying to fly an airplane, any other airplane. That plane came back, and that plane brought us back. It was a marriage, I'll tell you.
Painted words on the side of a B-17 with its nose broken off read, Old Bill. A painted man beside the words holds up a peace sign. On another plane, a painting of a female devil sits beside the words, Dame Satan.
A lot of guys, they'd name their own planes. And they had all kinds of kooky names.
Writing on various planes reads, Hell's a Poppin', Longhorn, and Pie-Eyed Piper.
The original crews had a lot of good painters, and they had a lot of planes that were decorated and had logos on them and so on.
In a painting next to the words, Chief Sly 2, a brown-skinned man with an exposed red butt holds a yellow bomb in his hand above an explosion.
Vargas girls, like petty girls, Vargas girls, sexy girls, there weren't too many serious things, I think, to keep guys loose.
A painting of a slim brunette white woman in a short red outfit sits on the side of the Memphis Belle. A long line of painted yellow bombs, some with colored stars above them, sits next to her. The scene fades to black. Text, cold air. Unlike modern airliners, B-17s were neither pressurized nor heated. At 25,000 feet, crews endured conditions equivalent to standing at the summit of Mount Everest. At these temperatures, frostbite can occur within 10 minutes. In footage from inside a plane, five B-17s fly in steady formation. A cloud obscures them.
Well, on a warm day, it would be 20 below. Sometimes it got 60 below. And oftentimes, I had to take my oxygen mask and crack the ice out of it and check if it would freeze into the tube. That was one of the worst parts of the mission, was the cold air. The only time you didn't feel it is when you were fighting fighters or going over the target.
In shaky footage, an airman wearing an oxygen mask waits by a machine gun.
Oh, at 30,000 feet, I think the temperature drops 2 degrees every thousand. It'd be about 40 below at that altitude. In the cockpit, a little bit of heat came off a number 3 engine that came into the cockpit there where the pilot and I sat. And it's enough to kind of keep your feet warm and your hands.
Something flaps quickly next to one of the airmen as he sits in a shadowed area of the plane.
Our ball turret gunner had a gun problem. His gun jammed and he took his gloves off to work on it. And both his hands got frostbitten and he didn't fly with us for a month until his hands healed up.
A B-17 flies against a backdrop of white clouds in a blue sky.
Well, it was so cold. On one mission, our co-pilot suffered an anoxia situation where he passed out and his hand froze to the plexiglass window. And then he had to amputate the fingers of his hand because it was so cold that his hand, when he tried to help himself, froze to the plexiglass window.
Distant planes fly forward slowly. A closer plane's propeller spins. Inside a plane, light reflects against a window as dozens of B-17s fly outside. The scene fades to black. Text, over here. By 1944, strict rationing and regular bombing raids had taken their toll on British morale. That same year, more than 2 million American servicemen were stationed in England. This friendly occupation could also take its toll on British morale. B-17s fly above England. They move in the far distance from a tall stone building.
Well, the British treated us very nice, in some cases royally.
Royal family visit. May 26, 1943.
They call it the friendly invasion because we flat invaded that country.
King George VI and Queen Elizabeth. Uniformed servicemen stand in a line. The king and queen approach them.
England is a small country. We had it absolutely covered up with American soldiers. And they tolerated us.
Queen Elizabeth says something to one of the servicemen. She and King George VI walk around surrounded by military personnel. They get into the back seat of a car. Elsewhere, an airman scoops snow off the ground.
I was single then. I could run around, do whatever I wanted, but I didn't feel uncomfortable with the British people at all. Once I got to be able to understand the language, because that English language is a little different than ours.
Men play tennis.
Very good people. As you know, at the beginning of the war, they weren't too enamored by the Yanks coming over. They said we were overpaid, oversexed, and over here. I remember that.
One of the tennis players, a shirtless white man, stands by a chain-link fence near a smiling blonde white woman. The scene cuts to black. Text, big thunderstorm. Close to one-third of all 8th Air Force losses were caused by high-explosive shells called flak. More than 1 million Germans, manning 40,000 guns, were waiting for the formations to arrive over Europe. These guns could fire rounds that could explode precisely on target, 6 miles straight up. A large group of B-17s flies through the air.
Flak is German 88-millimeter cannon shells. Flak was responsible for more planes being shot down than enemy fighters. And when you see flak, black puffs of smoke, that's after the shell, of course, has exploded. And it explodes, hypothetically, into 200 pieces. And It's powerful.
An airman wearing an oxygen mask puts on a helmet.
You don't know where the flak is coming from. You don't know if the next burst is going to hit you or not. You never know where the next one is going to be in a case like that, and that's what scares you.
Black smoke hangs in the air.
Well, it just looked like a big thunderstorm, so to speak. That's what it amounted to. But you had to keep on flying.
Puffs of black flak smoke float high above the ocean.
God was on your side when you didn't get hit. The flak would vary so much. The Germans had pretty good radar. They could judge your altitude, your speed, and your direction.
B-17s fly steadily past the various puffs of smoke.
I think the worst that I ever had over Kassel, Germany, I'll never forget that one. It blew my windshield out and coming to my face at 160 miles an hour.
White vapor streams off the wing of a plane. Shaky footage captures more dark smoke from flak.
You look at that flak out there and you swear you're not going to get through it. The sky's almost black with these things busting all over the place. It's amazing we did make it through as much as we did.
Pale craters mark the ground below. The scene fades to black. Text, superstitious. A dog with reddish gold fur sits on the front of a B-17.
Well, we had a dog and it looked more like a pig than a dog, but it was our mascot.
The dog sits in the cockpit with one of the airmen. He pats it. The dog rests its paws on the edge of the window. A black dog tilts its head.
We had a stove in the middle of the barracks, and we used to make sandwiches on it and so forth. If the dog was around, we'd feed him whatever we had left over. He hung around the barracks until we got back. I don't know if he had a name or not. It was a faithful little dog, but it had a real wide nose.
A covered military vehicle drives past one of the parked planes. Some of the mechanics work beneath one of the planes.
Oh, you get superstitious. I remember I had to put on a clean pair of socks the day I was shot down. I'd been wearing the same pair of socks. Evidently, I think a pup got one of my socks and was chewing on it and hit it. I couldn't find it that morning. I had to put on a clean pair of socks. That might have been the reason I was shot down.
You ought to believe this or not, but somewhere around the 10th or 12th mission, I got to a point, and I know some of the other fellas reached the same thing, that they were feeling blasé. They didn't get us up to here. They ain't going to get us here on.
Some of the airmen play a throwing game.
I was somewhat superstitious. I always felt God would bring me home, and I mean that sincerely. However, I wasn't sure if it would be in one piece.
One man tosses an object. Another man whacks him in the arm.
I flew 5 days in a row, 5 missions. And I remember at a 4th or 5th one, you really didn't care. You were worn out. You wanted to get away from it.
I saw a lot of them break under pressure. Come back and told a flight surgeon, I can't fly anymore. And they didn't. Nobody pointed their finger at them and ridiculed them. Nobody.
Small holes and bloodstains mark the side of a helmet. The scene cuts to black. Text, kill a human. A B-17 could carry 2 tons of bombs to a target 1,000 miles away. A formation could place an average of 1/3 of their bombs within 1,000 feet of the intended target. Accuracy would decrease dramatically in adverse flying conditions. Dozens of B-17s fly against a clear blue sky.
Yes, the bomb run. That was the worst. It's because you had to keep everything steady. If you weren't on a bomb run, you could slide over once in a while and they'd think it'd miss you. But on a bomb run, you just had to sit there and take it.
four planes fly close together.
Try to shrivel up, I guess.
Well, the lead ship does it all. You just follow what he does. The lead ship and then the two on each side, and one down there and one up here and around there.
Various planes fly in formation over the ocean toward land.
I was flying right above the leader, and when you're watching him and you see the bomb doors open, then you open too. And then you wait for him to drop bombs, and when he drops bombs, then you drop.
Open doors at the bottom of one of the planes reveals a city below. The door opens wider. A B-17 flies with the bomb bay doors open.
We can't change our altitude, and we can't change our direction. And we're what you call sitting ducks at that moment.
An airman adjusts his helmet.
It was rough, because any minute you were going to get hit.
The bombardier pushes forward a lever. Outside, blurs of dark smoke hang in the air. Multiple bombs drop out of a plane. Large bombs drop from a B-17's belly. They fall past clouds towards a patch of land below. A plane drops two bombs. Another plane releases multiple bombs in quick succession. Gray smoke billows where the bombs hit below. A B-17 releases different colored bombs. They fall toward the earth quickly. Multiple bombs explode around areas divided by roads. Their resulting smoke blossoms upwards. In footage taken from above, two B-17s fly high over a city near a body of water.
The bombs are dropped, bombs away, and the first thing you hear is, "Let's get the hell out of here." Well, we make a sharp turn, and the group follows the lead.
A group of B-17s turns.
After a while, fighters, tanks started coming in, and they didn't miss very often.
From inside a plane, a ray of light illuminates a gunner's face. He blinks and squints slightly. A shadowed airman moves throughout the plane's interior. Two gunners aim the barrels of their machine guns and shoot. Casings fall in a pile on the floor. One gunner shifts them with his foot. Outside, a thin stream of dark smoke trails from the back of a plane. A second plane flies lower.
They'd be out 20, 30 miles, and they'd come right straight at your level.
Light flashes from the muzzle of a machine gun as a gunner shoots. In shaky footage, a plane flies away.
You couldn't hit anything with those guns I had back there. By the time you saw a guy, he was gone. I mean, you see one coming? He's gone.
In footage from inside a B-17, another plane zips past. Planes fly above cloud coverage. A plane appears small as it moves in the distance. In a B-17, one of the gunners pulls something on his machine gun. He slams something into place with his hand, then aims the gun again.
You don't have much time to shoot at them. If you get off a burst or two, you're lucky. They go zoop!
A distant plane flies alone. A light flashes. Smoke bursts from the distant plane. More lights flash as shots hit the plane again.
He'll drop off, he'll slide down, and then he'll line up on you. And then he'll peel off.
Small lights move downwards as a plane flies off. Inside a B-17, one of the airmen blinks and looks outside. The wind ruffles his jacket. A turret turns as its guns fire. The twin barrels shake with the force of the shots. A faraway plane continues to fly away. The scene cuts to black. Dozens of planes fly in close formation.
The co-pilot was hit pretty hard when we were shot down. A 20-millimeter shell popped right above his head and knocked an eye out.
So it was high noon, and ME-109 was back there blasting at us. And I heard the co-pilot, he said, "Jesus Christ, number four's on fire. Get out."
Unsteady footage of a B-17 from behind.
When that thing is spinning and heading down, you're glued to your seat. You couldn't move if you wanted to.
A plane flies to the side, then plummets.
And you're lucky if you see two or three guys bail out. We would count the chutes, and usually if we start to look too long after a ship that was going down, the pilot would say, "Okay, guys, off." We didn't want to spend too much time looking at a plane going down when we had, you know, fighters in the area and so forth.
A gunner looks out the open side of his plane. Outside, puffy white clouds break up the blue sky. A small plane flies below.
The gunners and the others that were watching all the time would tell you, "Boy, I don't think anybody got out of that one. Nobody got out." And then sometimes you'd see chutes coming out of them before they blew up or anything.
A white parachute drifts through the air.
If you didn't have your chute on and get out of there in less than 30 seconds, you're gone. You're gone. And 7 out of 11 out of my crew got out alive. And one of them, when he got on the ground, they pitchforked him to death. How can you kill a human like that?
A contrail streams behind a plane as it flies away. The scene cuts to black. Text, red flare. After bombs were dropped, the trip home began, a journey that could take 5 hours. Both the airplanes and the men they contained might be badly damaged. At home base, the plane and body count would begin. At a base, various servicemen look into the sky.
As we approach the field, we set off flares. Red flares means you have wounded aboard. Everybody else gets out of the way and a wounded comes in first.
Two flares arc through the air, one yellow and one red. Below, a uniformed woman looks upward through a pair of binoculars. Men stand with their hands on a railing. People watch from various places around the base. One of the planes lowers its landing gear. Smoke flies up behind a plane's wheels as it lands on a runway. Two men help an injured airman out of one of the planes. The arm of the airman's jacket hangs loose below his wrist. The men help the airman lie on the ground. In a medical area, a red liquid sits inside a clear container and runs through an attached tube. A man lies under a gray blanket. Someone puts a cigarette to his lips. He opens his mouth slightly and accepts it.
To this day, I still see it. When I think of it, I choke up. I can't help it. They were friends of mine. They were good friends. And it hurt so bad. Especially, we all felt like, what a waste.
Footage of various damaged planes.
With the job we had, the chance of dying was at least 50%. 50% chance of living, 50% chance of dying.
People stand around a damaged B-17.
You know, a guy said, "Your name's on it." Well, maybe it was. But it was scary. And I get very irritated when I hear some of these guys say, "I wasn't scared one bit. They're full of prunes."
A white airman in a cap brings a cigarette to his lips.
"I was scared every time."
The airman in the cap smokes. A B-17's propellers spin as it wheels around a field.
I went out to a ship one time when they were taking a young fellow off. And I thought I could help them. The guy they were pulling out of the ship.
Men bring a covered body out of a plane.
He was calling for his mother.
The scene cuts to black. Text, just Germans. By the end of the war, bomber crews had destroyed or rendered uninhabitable 3.6 million German homes. People walk past a building with broken windows. It is estimated they killed 300,000 civilians and wounded another 780,000. Trees grow around the ruins of a building. 7.5 million German civilians were made homeless. In aerial footage, various damaged buildings fill a city. The shadow of a plane moves across a bombed area.
In about late 1944, the Allies decided to do away with precision bombing. We went to pattern bombing. Unfortunately, killed a lot of people, but brought the war to a close about a year sooner.
More buildings in various states of damage sit within the dense city.
The United States military did not go out to carpet bomb civilians or anything. They went out to bomb factories, rail yards, refineries, and places that had something to do with the war. I don't think that I felt bad about that at all. That's what we're supposed to do. But toward the end of the war, the Germans would not give up.
The husk of a structure sits on a stretch of dirt. Germany, summer 1945. People walk past a pile of debris outside a building. Melted blobs obscure the writing on a store's sign. Gold letters on the side of a bombed building read, Leiser.
Never thought a thing about it. We didn't think about people being down there. I never crossed my mind about a human being being down there.
A woman puts something inside a bag sitting on a cart. The remnants of a weapon point toward her. A group of women stands on a pile of debris outside a building.
Never gave it a thought. They're just Germans. You know, and I never gave it a thought.
Women stand in lines up the side of a pile of rubble. Some of the lines transfer buckets up the pile one by one.
For some reason, I didn't hate them. If I had a fighter plane come within shooting distance, my thought was, this kid probably wanted to live as bad as you did. I really didn't have any hate for him. I'm just scared of him.
A child sits on the back of a hand-pulled cart.
Never gave it a thought. I honestly never gave it a thought. I just felt this way. They're going to do it to us. We better do it to them before they do it to us. And that's the way I felt, and I couldn't help it.
A white woman in a blue dress pulls a handcart up a street. A child sits on the back along with pieces of wood. The woman pulls the cart slowly. The scene cuts to black. Text. They're the heroes. An old, balding white man sits in front of a laptop and watches footage of B-17s. William Toombs, Little Rock, Arkansas, railroad worker, age 93. The old man, William, sits still as he watches.
Bring any thoughts what seeing that?
Oh, I drifted off into several thoughts. Most of them, you know, were bad thoughts when you're looking at a mission. I see what took place on that mission, and your mind drifts back to those times, you know.
A black and white photo of a crew posing before a plane. An old white-haired white man watches the documentary footage on a laptop. John Doyle, Cornville, Arizona, manufacturer's representative, age 92.
We had a lot of mid-air collisions. Some guys would get mixed up, pilots, and they'd start flying the wrong direction and so on. But the scary part, most of our mission, was just getting through all of that.
Did it get easier or harder as you flew more missions?
I just, like I say, I was scared to death, but those were not good days.
A white man in a blue and white plaid shirt sits on a couch and watches the footage. Glenn Harrison, St. Louis, Missouri, engineer, age 97.
There was no radio communication at all. We had intercom going all the time, though, at checking the men with the oxygen mask on, make sure their oxygen was flowing right. Especially the tail gunner, he was laying back there by himself so much.
The scene fades to a black and white photo of Glenn smiling as a young airman.
You get very close to the men and everything, and they're all young kids. They're all dead now, I'm sure.
In footage from a plane, puffs of black flak smoke hang in the air. Robert Rowland, McClure, Ohio, machinist slash farmer, age 92.
When you're that high up, everything on the ground looks like a little toy. If you see a truck or something, it really looks small. It was hard, but you had to do it. We had to get rid of Hitler, and so we did it.
In his home, the bald white man, Bud, watches the documentary footage on a laptop. Paul Bud Hedicke, O'Fallon, Missouri, regional sales manager, age 92.
You guys know that some bombs went through the wings of B-17s? I always wondered how in the world they were out of position in formation. God's been good to me. First of all, he's given me 70 years with that lady over there. And we have a wonderful family.
A wedding photo of young Bud and his wife.
We had 6 kids, and we have 20 grandkids, 22 great-grandkids. So we've been a very blessed family. I didn't say I want them all at the house at once.
Signatures sit over a photo of a crew. Al Villagran, St. Louis, Missouri, lighting manufacturer, age 94.
What do you think about the good war, and you're the greatest generation?
Well, I'm beginning to believe it. Does that make sense to you? I know you kind of grew up 10 years when you went into that thing. And when I came back home, I didn't feel like the same man anymore.
In the signed photo, young Al stands at the end of a row. John Ketzner, Parkville, Maryland, railroad executive, age 96.
What do you say to people who say, you know, John, you're a hero, you're a hero?
I say, okay, you're probably right. I don't know what else to say. I wasn't one of them heroes, the guys that finish their tour and sign up for another one. I wasn't them kind of heroes.
V.G. Alexander, Lexington, Kentucky.
I want it clearly known. I do not profess myself to be a hero. I was a pilot. The heroes are bred in England, Germany, and France. The boys did me. They're the heroes. I was just a normal pilot.
In footage from inside a plane, a B-17 drops bombs. More bombs fall to the earth. In a house, an old white man in a plaid shirt sits in a cushioned chair and watches the documentary footage. Mort Kimmel, State College, Pennsylvania, Home Improvements, age 94. He watches the footage of bombs being dropped.
This is called pattern bombing.
He gestures to the laptop screen. Footage plays of over a dozen B-17s flying.
No offense, but you guys aren't getting any younger. And why do you think it's important that people know what you guys did?
Well, for one thing, we don't want it to happen again, in fact or in fancy. We just don't want it to happen again for my grandson, my granddaughters and their husbands. I don't want to see them have to face
what we did.
Cursive handwriting on a black and white photo of a crew posing reads, "Destined to be a famous crew." The young airmen grin in front of a B-17. The shadow of a B-17 moves over a grassy landscape. The footage zooms in on the front of the plane's shadow. Text. This film is dedicated to cinematographer Harold Tannenbaum and the 28,000 men who gave their lives in the service of the 8th Air Force. A runway rushes beneath the shadow. The scene cuts to black. Credits play beside footage of Bud wearing an oxygen mask.
I cannot say it much more eloquently. It was a hazardous profession. Okay, up at altitude, and of course, bombs away and all, and you got this on. I think fear more than anything. You'd perspire and sweat. You got this on? Ice it for them. And you take a deep breath and break the ice out of the oxygen mask, and then put it back on.
He bends to pick something up.
This is Bud trying to get down on the floor. This is the Mae West. Remember I told you about the oxygen? I mean the CO2 cylinder? This is it. There it is, CO2 cylinder. This was before underarm deodorant, hairspray. I think this was the birth of aerosol containers. And if guys bailed out, they didn't want it totally inflated a couple hundred feet up, because if they hit the water, they could break their backs. So it wasn't that easy. I never did it. This is a throat mic. This is how I talked to Eric. And this plugged in. And as I showed you on the helmet, this is how I heard. So we had our communication system.
But to be clear, this should have been returned to the government in 1945.
Come and get them, baby.
Well, this, what we just did with you might be the credit roll to our movie. So do you have any messages for people who have just watched this movie?
Well, I'm just so glad that people in America or anywhere can get an idea of what 19 and 20 and 21-year-old kids went through. And as I tell kids when I get done with my talk, I'm going to ask you guys a favor now. What's that, Bud? When you go home tonight, you say a prayer of thanks to God for those 28,000 guys that gave their lives so that you got the life you got today.
The scene fades to black.
Thank you for your service, Bud.
Not at all. Not at all.
Audio description provided by International Digital Center, written by Betty Capo, voiced by Mike Tricario. To Adarsh, 1964 to 2018. Copyright 2018 Vulcan Productions Incorporated and Creative Differences Productions Incorporated. All rights reserved. A logo, HBO, a presentation of Home Box Office.